You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on August 10th, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, co-hosts Nate and Kelly join me to catch up on analyzing key news stories from Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran, and how it all relates to or affects U.S. policy in the region. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me back in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
And on the line is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we've been saving some of the foreign policy topics for several weeks now, so I figured we should probably dive into some of those. Particularly, I want to look at sort of U.S.-related stories in the Middle East. And I want to start with Syria. There's a whole bunch of things that you could talk about that are going on in Syria right now. But there are two particular angles that I've found interesting. One of them that hasn't gotten that much attention is the ongoing purported U.S. bombing of the quote-unquote Khorasan group. I wrote a long thing on arsenalfordemocracy.com a few weeks ago about how it's super unclear what this is. But basically, what happened was a year or so ago, because it's now August or whatever, so we started bombing Syria in, I think, September of 2014. So almost a year ago, the U.S. suddenly told the media that they were attacking a cell of terrorists in Syria called the Khorasan group. Now, basically, no national security people, and these are the people who are, like, a lot of times already themselves pretty wrong about a lot of things, even basically none of them had heard of this before. And the U.S. is trying to say this is a group of, like, hardened, you know, masterminds, people involved with 9/11, people planning 9/11 style attacks. They're based in Syria, but they're not from the Syrian, you know, uprising or anything. They're all from Afghanistan or Iran or wherever, like just random places that sound scary. And they, you know, started targeting this. And there were a few journalists who were skeptical. Some journalists, you know, as many media outlets have done, just sort of reported this uncritically. And that's a problem we can talk about. But a few journalists were like, nah, this seems a little odd that, like, we're just now hearing about this the day that these airstrikes start on this group and no one else has heard of them before. And the sort of the most damning evidence on this was that when reporters talked to actual Syrians in the areas that were getting bombed, they consistently said, no, there is no such group. We've never heard of that. And the targets that are being bombed are all Nusra Front targets. Nusra Front is the division of Al-Qaeda that is operating in Syria right now that has been very successful among all the different sort of quote-unquote rebel groups. And they're jihadists, and they are both anti-American and anti-Assad and anti-ISIS. But they have a lot of influence. So it seems like the U.S. maybe made up a group to attack that was actually just part of this other group, because they didn't want to say they were attacking it directly. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on what the deal is with that, but I found the whole thing very bizarre. And then a few weeks ago, and this is what made me, like, really, you know, think about this in even more depth than I had when it started, is that the U.S. announced that it had killed some guy, right? And then people started pointing out that this guy has supposedly been killed in U.S. airstrikes two times before. So this was the third time this one guy, this mastermind terrorist from a fictional group, had been killed. So I'm just kind of wondering, like, what is going on with the U.S. war effort here? What is, like, is any, like, it seems like all of it has become pure propaganda that doesn't make any sense anymore. And unfortunately, a lot of the media outlets don't seem to have the staffs to, like, really look into this. And they're just sort of, like, printing up press releases. Nate, what was your reaction to this?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it is kind of worrying. That, you know, we're not exactly sure who we're fighting over there and, you know, what targets these bombs are actually going towards. I mean, just a situation where there's so little on-the-ground intelligence, as you've noted, there's, you know, not a ton of media exposure. And often in these types of situations, like, what little media exposure can be coming from either embedded sources or sources where you're not, like, 100% sure of the credibility of them. So it makes it even more difficult to figure out what exactly is going on.
According to various sources that I had read, Muhsin al-Fadli has been killed in 3 separate airstrikes in Syria. I think 2 of them were last year in September. So he was killed twice last September, and then he was killed once in July a few weeks ago. I want to read a few quotations from last September from news reports. This is a New York Times. American officials said that the group called Khorasan had emerged in the past year. There is almost no public information about the Khorasan group.
Is that Khorasan as in Star Wars?
I don't know. I don't think it's like Khorasan. I think
it's got some Star Wars fans amongst terrorists.
As far as I can tell, honestly, it seems to be named after the Khorasan region of Iran that this one particular dude like allegedly operated in, which again, that in itself is a little questionable. An Al-Qaeda guy operating in Iran, like, I guess maybe there is some stuff happening over there, but it just, that is a little puzzling. Another quote from the same article, New York Times: it is unclear who besides Mr. Fadli is part of the Khorasan group. So potentially this is a quote unquote group that is one guy who has now been killed multiple times. And then other people just said it was an offshoot of the Nusra Front. Washington Post article, also last September: a little-known but well-resourced Al-Qaeda cell that some American officials fear could pose a direct threat to the United States. Like, what is this? They're just, like, there doesn't seem to be any sense of proportionality or anything going on. It's just, it's constantly just reacting to different things. It's like, oh, this is a threat, this is a threat, this is a threat. There's no, like, hierarchy of ranking priorities or anything. There's no sense of proportion of, like, how big of a threat is this? Well, no, all of them are huge, massive threats. And I like, that's just the thing that's sort of puzzling. There was a BuzzFeed article that was literally titled "How Khorasan Went from Nowhere to the Biggest Threat to the U.S., which was just going through all these different, you know, NatSec people saying, I knew about the group a year ago from the media. I didn't know any names or personalities until the past few days, again, from the media. Let's see, other quotes. Los Angeles Times, November 2014: many opposition activists in Syria and elsewhere doubt the existence of Khorasan, and so on and so forth. This goes on and on, and then we get our illustrious leaders. Adam Schiff is the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. He said, when in the third time this guy was announced to have been killed, he said, a seasoned, knowledgeable, and dangerous terrorist who actively sought to harm the United States and its allies has been taken off the battlefield for good, and said that he could not be easily replaced. Like, what is even going on? This whole focus of the airstrikes in northwest Syria doesn't make any sense, because they don't seem to want to admit that they're targeting Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front, but they also, like, can't target them because at this point they're, like, Al-Qaeda has basically taken over the entire rebellion other than the ISIS people. And that's been a whole issue as well. Recently, the U.S. government or military admitted that their program that they've been working on for a year now to train fighters against ISIS consists of 60 people, and they are refusing to fight against Al-Qaeda, and are also being repeatedly attacked by Al-Qaeda because they're U.S. agents, essentially. Whether or not they're whether or not they see themselves that way, that's how Al-Qaeda sees them. So this whole situation just seems to be a total mess. And then the reason that I bring all this up first, which might seem just like really super narrow and abstract, is that the U.S. has now agreed to create a buffer zone in the same area, northwest Syria, north of Aleppo, or just like a little bit east of Aleppo. And it's not in the area where the Kurds have been. You know, we've heard a lot about that, the Kurdish fighters in Kobani and everything. And the Turkish government has requested this area for a really long time. They want it to be cleared of ISIS because ISIS occupies a lot of the villages there, but they also don't want the Syrian government to have it. They don't seem to really care if Al-Qaeda gets it, and we're just trying to clear this humanitarian zone. You can see all the maps of it on arsenalfordemocracy.com. I had drawn out a map and everything of where this is probably going to be located, and maybe there's even going to be Turkish ground troops at some point. We don't know, but this whole plan, it basically consists of clearing out this area and then being like, well, who's going to fill it? okay, not Turkey, because they don't want to go in right now with actual ground troops. The military has basically said they really don't want to do this, especially without figuring out a government, because Turkey still hasn't formed a government since the elections. And then the bigger thing here, we've seen the only like group that has had any success against ISIS in Syria has been the Kurdish fighters, and they are literally calling in airstrikes with exact coordinates to the United States. There was a whole New York Times feature on this week.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at it right now. They've got like iPads and like tablets. They're calling in the GPS coordinates for the airstrikes. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it is a testament, I guess, to like the accuracy. When the U.S. has really good ground intelligence, it's a testament to how accurate the bombing can be. When they don't have good ground intelligence and don't have good ground, like people on the ground supporting them, it doesn't work out very well. And part of this deal, the U.S. is denying this, but Turkey is saying part of the deal was that the U.S. agreed that they wouldn't let the Kurds into this zone. Now, I don't know if they can do that, but again, this just seems like, okay, so what are you going to do? Hand it over to Al-Qaeda? I mean, there are not a lot of options here, and you're not going to hold this huge area. I mean, it's a very large area that we're talking about. You're not going to hold it with 60 guys from Division 30, the like euphemistic weird new CIA front since the last CIA-backed rebel group collapsed. I mean, I don't know. Like, it seems like we're just going around in circles here on this, and none of the policy in Syria makes any sense. And I'm not saying like, oh, that means the U.S. should send in 100,000 troops or something like that. I'm just saying, what are we doing?
I think what you're describing is a pretty bad cycle we're in right now, where the American public is fatigued from war and news about war and, you know, lies about war. And so they have largely stopped paying attention, allowing politicians and people involved in these security decisions to get away with essentially anything. Such as killing the same man three times before anybody notices. So I think this is going to be a really hard cycle to break, but one that, you know, in the coming election, Americans really have to stand up and say, we remember we're at war. We're, you know, perhaps on the precipice of entering quite a few other wars. What are you going to do about it?
You can't help but have this sense that the U.S. is just sort of careening from like mini crisis to mini crisis, not coming up with any sort of overarching thing, not like having any sense of perspective, I guess is the word I would use. And it's weird because this is not the only place where we have sort of crisis of the day or crisis of the hour situations. I mean, you think about various areas of Africa that we talk about periodically on the show. Like, imagine if the U.S. were constantly launching, you know, airstrikes on the spur of the moment here and there, like all over West Africa or Central Africa or any of these places. But we don't do that. And I'm not saying that our response in Africa is good either, but like it just, none of it makes any sense. There's no sort of sense of like a strategic plan for the, you know, what we want to do in the world.
Well, one thing I would say is that certain areas of Africa don't quite have the resources that are, you know, just in the area in the Middle East. Not saying that that is the determining factor of every aspect of our foreign policy, but it's certainly a consideration. And I mean, once you start to factor in all that, it's not all that surprising the amount of focus we've put on the Middle East in the past couple of years, rather than, you know, Central Africa or somewhere in West Africa where there are humanitarian crises, but not maybe not necessarily the U.S. oil interests or resource interests that, you know, would spur the U.S. to say, okay, now we need to exercise our military power to safeguard our interests in this area. And usually we don't do that just humanitarian crises, even though you could argue that that should be our main, you know, foreign military focus, you know, helping out other people rather than just securing our own resources and stuff. So, you know, that's perhaps maybe not too surprising, but the thing is, the Middle East is so incredibly diverse that, you know, it's not just as simple as, okay, we're going to fight a war there and get a lot of oil and increase our economic, you know, resources or whatever. It's okay, now we got to play this terrorist group off of that regime, which is in turn allied with this regime, but they're also our allies, but then they were our enemies like 2 years ago. So it's just back and forth, and you know, you're really not end up, you're sort of just, it's like the game of like Rush Hour. You're just pushing a thing one way and then having to pull it back, and you just get jumbled into a giant puzzle and you have nowhere really to go that's at all effective. So that's maybe an analogy that we're seeing here. It is also, one other thing, you mentioned this buffer zone between Turkey and Syria that we're seeing develop. And my wonder would be, is this a way long-term of allowing the Kurds to, or will this lead to a situation where the Kurds are able to carve out more of a like longer lasting area, maybe not a fully independent country or anything, but do you think it's possible that they'll gain long-term control over these areas of Syria as well as the areas of Iraq that they already live in?
Well, I mean, that seems to be the concern that Turkey has and why they're demanding that the U.S. quote-unquote keep the Kurds out of this area, despite the fact that they've had this close, successful cooperation. I mean, it's not a majority Kurdish area that we're talking about in these villages. And there have been some problems that we've seen in Iraq, according to, I think, Foreign Affairs magazine, did some on-the-ground reporting of talking about Arab villages that are empty because they were evacuated ahead of ISIS coming in. And then the Kurds pushed ISIS out, but then didn't let the Arabs come back and actually started some units, you know, not apparently with orders from the top, but renegade units, we'll call them. Began burning down some of these villages or destroying property to basically make sure that the Arabs couldn't come back. Regardless of Turkey's motives, I think they are probably correct in wondering if a, you know, huge buffer zone is carved out and it's between these two Kurdish areas, even if it's not majority Kurdish there, you know, is this potentially now empty turf that the Kurds are going to fill up? But then again, there is that question of Turkish motives. This was an area that was very hotly contested between Turkey and France right after World War I, during the Turkish War of Independence and various wars between Turkey and France that don't get very much discussion, that occurred in the early 1920s that sort of ended up setting the border between Turkey and Syria. And we talked about this a little bit before with that weird tomb thing, the tomb of Süleyman Shah, and how Turkey, you know, had this sort of little extraterritorial thing going on. But this is, you know, potentially, if you're a Turkish nationalist, this is an area that was wrongly taken from you by the French that you want to get back. And you might say, oh man, that was so long ago. You know, what could they be thinking of? It's not even majority Turkish citizens living there. But, you know, if you look at the situation in northern Cyprus, Turkey has been occupying that militarily since 1974. And that wasn't majority Turkish either when they sent troops in. And that's basically just a sort of permanent, like, quote unquote, humanitarian intervention that Turkey has going on. So I think there's a big risk here that Turkey is making a play for taking this territory for themselves. And I think definitely the ruling party, or the sort of ruling party, given what happened with the elections, the AKP, is basically trying to, like, they've said, okay, whatever, the Kurds are not going to vote for us anymore. Let's just go ahead and attack them, try to get this buffer zone in Syria, and let's win that nationalist vote. Let's get nationalist voters to vote for us, the Islamist party, even if they are not themselves Islamist. That seems to be their strategy. They seem to be gunning for a new election there. And I just think, like, the U.S. is basically turning a blind eye to the situation that's going on. I realize Turkey's an important ally, et cetera, et cetera. But at a certain point, Turkey's been letting all these jihadists in for years now into Syria, for 4 or 5 years, and really not doing anything about it. They've been very unhelpful, other than taking the refugees. I mean, that's important. But beyond that, they have been extremely unhelpful. They haven't stopped any of the smuggling networks that have been keeping ISIS alive. There's a lot going on here that Turkey is responsible for in Syria, of actively causing problems and undercutting and undermining U.S. policy. And we don't seem to be taking that into account. We're now prepared to, like, sell out the Syrian Kurds that we've been working with very effectively in favor of working with Turkey that has not been working with us very effectively recently. And they're just in, like, they're going to frame that in strategic terms, but I don't think it's being taken in strategic terms. I mean, ironically, it seems like one of the few things that we're being strategic about at all is the Iran deal. You know, there are people saying, well, you know, we should be doing X, Y, and Z with regard to Ukraine and, again, you know, standing up to Russia. But of course, Russia's been a very important partner in the Iran negotiations. And we've basically, I mean, I don't want to say we've sacrificed the situation in Ukraine, but we've had to make, like, a strategic decision there of saying, you know what, we're going to have to circle back and deal with Ukraine later, because we can't afford to completely alienate Russia. We still need to be able to walk into a room and talk to them about something else, even if it's not directly about them, or else world security is going to be in danger. I also wonder if there's a risk that U.S. air superiority and sort of technological superiority in military terms has made us basically think that because we have the capability of doing something, we should do it. Because we can instantly do airstrikes within a matter of hours, that we should. You know, maybe we need to be thinking a little bit harder about that. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line is Kelly. I also wanted to talk a little bit about Iraq. I actually wanted to talk about something that's not related to the war with ISIS, which is in Baghdad. So for folks who haven't been paying attention, there is this huge heat wave happening in the Middle East right now. So on top of all the other problems, you've got this giant heat wave. We've got temperatures, you know, after sundown even, of 120 degrees or more in places like Baghdad and Tehran. In Iraq, most of the focus in the past few months or the past year, even longer, has been on ISIS occupying a huge area of northwest Iraq. Now there's a new focus, especially in Baghdad. I mean, they've sort of kind of contained the security situation, so there's not directly that much violence happening in Baghdad itself related to the war. But still, kind of a remarkable scene. People taking to the streets, despite all this heat, to basically protest and say, hey, you guys are super incompetent at governing, and we don't have any electricity to power our air conditioners, because in the entire more than a decade since the U.S. withdrew, or turned over control, rather, to the Iraqi authorities, you have not taken upon it yourself to fix the, you know, electrical grid or any of these things. There's so much corruption going on. And then this has sort of bloomed into an even larger protest, not just specifically about electricity problems, although that's a big concern, but also saying, look, you're not running the government very effectively in general. This is a real mess, and, you know, we need actual governance here. And some of that does end up tying back to the war, of course. One of the specific protests was how high-ranking officials have hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers protecting them at all times, you know, very far from the battlefield. That's sort of been a holdover from the sort of peak of the Iraq war, violence, the insurgency and everything. And so if they scale back the security details on some of these officials, they could potentially free up 10,000 or more troops to be able to go to the front lines to fight against ISIS. These demands are sort of all interrelated, but I thought it was interesting that we're actually seeing this sort of good governance push happening here. Kelly, had you been following this story at all?
Yeah, it actually caught my eye because it appeared to be fairly good news. I mean, our hope in the Middle East is that they want good governance for themselves. So obviously it's a long road, but I was encouraged to see that, you know, at least those conversations are happening around dinner tables and at mosques. So what they demand and what their politicians give to them might not be exactly what we want, but I think that it's a good seed to plant, that they're starting to think about what they want for themselves and for their country. And air conditioning is a great place to start.
Yeah, I think this is a reflection of just the utter breakdown of civil services that has been going on for the past several years.
Decades.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is there was never a strong civil service built up under Saddam anyway, but at least there was at least something there. But obviously after the invasion, after the, you know, long wars after that, you were just, you know, stuck in a situation where, you know, it's 108 degrees Fahrenheit at night in Baghdad at times, 122 during the day. So, you know, you've got just no air conditioning. Fans have to be shut off all but a couple hours a day due to electricity shortages, massive protests just as a result. You know, people taking showers with their clothes on or like lining up to buy blocks of ice in the street. I mean, this is just the kind of stuff that you see right there right now. And, you know, this is particularly dangerous, I feel like, because, okay, you have this area that has not been particularly stable over the past, 20 years, a lot of ethnic fault lines, and now you're just creating a situation where it's hot, there's, you know, very little excess water, and, you know, it just, I'm not saying it's going to lead to some sort of resurgence of like ethnic violence, but at the same time, you just have a lot of people that are very unhappy right now, and that's going to lead to protests and dissatisfaction with the government.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the course of world history, many a major event or upheaval has been triggered by an extreme heat wave. This would not be the first time that there's some sort of a big political transformation or something, but you always hope that it's going to be a positive political transformation rather than people, you know, butting heads on the street and having the...
hitting each other with blocks of ice.
Yeah, the national level version of gang violence breaking out because it's hot in the city, you know? And I think also that one of the big features that happened here was that the Shiite militias that have become so sort of politically influential have become really, like, supportive of these protests, which, I mean, again, not that it's great to have armed groups backing various political factions. I think we saw what happened in Yemen when everyone has an armed group backing their political agenda from behind the scenes. But it is positive to see that this has been a relatively broad-based mobilization. The fact that it's these Shia militias rallying against both the Prime Minister Abadi, former Prime Minister Maliki, any of these folks, you know, saying, look, you know, regardless of the situation in the war, you're just not doing a good job on the actual governance front. I think that's an important message to hear from a diverse range of people. But yeah, to me, it does also seem like a relatively positive development. In the sense that this is, as Kelly said, you know, this is good news in a way because it's something other than all the terrible news, and it's something, a sign of the potential to build democracy here in its own weird Iraqi way, that having people angrily rallying about ice and air conditioning is like, you know, I mean, that's going to be their baby steps,
right?
Yeah,
well, one of the central purposes of government is to provide, you know, decent standard of living for its citizens. And clearly we're seeing that the citizens are like, hey, by the way, it's blazing hot here. We have no water. Like this, we're clearly not being provided basic services. And, you know, this is actually something that's been present in the whole Iraq debacle for the past, I don't know, pretty much ever since the invasion, because you remember those stories coming out after the invasion, how the U.S., you know, goes to Baghdad and sends troops to protect, like, the oil ministry, and then meanwhile, like, the Iraqi Museum of History, which has artifacts, you know, going back to ancient Mesopotamia days, is getting looted and vandalized, and you're like, okay, well, I mean, clearly one thing is prioritized, and other aspects of governance aren't, and, you know, the fact that the U.S. couldn't set up effective electricity or water system in the time that they were there, that further shows that, you know, they weren't actually super interested in setting up a government or a real effective government that actually catered to the needs of people rather than just certain, you know, whatever faction that could back them most of the time. So, I mean, now we're seeing the results of that.
I think that's a really interesting point and one that I hadn't necessarily thought of in those terms, but you're right. I mean, you know, for all the talk of nation building, which is a, you know, it's a catchphrase or whatever, right? I mean, if you're doing actual nation building, it would have to involve, you know, reshaping what the purpose of government is and building good governance and things like that. And the only sort of government structures that were emphasized, as you said, was security and energy, making sure that we have, you know, a working functional military. That didn't even really happen. And making sure that we're protecting, you know, the oil pipelines and the oil production and everything, which we did a better job, I guess, of doing than some things, but still not even that great. And I don't think that we necessarily really transformed, for all that talk of, you know, bringing democracy to the Middle East and all that, did we actually change the debate? Did we change the way that people view their government? Or do they just view it in these sort of clientelistic terms of saying, like, you know, that the purpose of government is for everyone to get as much out of it as possible for their friends and, you know, have these imposing military forces that exist just to sustain themselves? And that's the whole thing with Egypt, certainly, right? The whole, like, everything has now become about the military. I mean, this was true before the revolution, you know, like less overtly, but now it's just wide out in the open. Is everything is about the military. It's about protecting the military. It's about keeping the military safe. It's about using the military. It's about the military being in government. It's about the military being in the economy, owning large, you know, companies, things like that. You know, if you look to other countries in Iran, you've got the military owning large companies and things like that as well. There's this sort of just emphasis on military everything and not focusing on these other vital components. I think at the beginning of the year, you had quotes from U.S. commanders and military folks who had been working on the final stages of Afghanistan before, you know, pulling back U.S. troops there. And they were saying, you know, we think that we're going to leave an Afghan army that's one of the most respected institutions in the country. Really? That's, we've been there for over a decade. We've been there for, you know, 13 years or more, 14 years. And the most respected institution that we're leaving behind is the army, which the Afghan army is garbage anyway. Hell, why didn't we just rebuild the monarchy when we came back in 2001? That would have been a more legitimate institution to build up and make the most trusted institution, you know, than the army. Like, what's the, why are we doing these quote unquote reconstruction efforts that don't come down to anything? We, you know, there's, well, all the, well, they talk about schools. We didn't even build those. Like, they've been doing investigative reporting on that and finding out that half these schools don't exist. Yeah. I mean, this is crazy.
Well, perhaps one of the reasons why we supported the army in that case was perhaps because we had previously supported the Mujahideen turning into the Taliban against the Soviets, but now you can't really support them because we're fighting against them, so you got to find a new, and then get the Northern Alliance, throw them in there, and the Kurds, and like previous warlords. And I mean, it's like going back to the point we had before, is that there's so much just, it's a puzzle. A lot of, and the pieces don't really fit together. So, you know, you just are stuck in these situations where you're just sort of dealing with these fractious just groups and factions in all these different countries that, you know, really aren't nations. I mean, they're countries. They're not really nations in the sense that you would have a nation of, you know, a similar like-minded group of people. And not to delve too deeply into this, but, you know, I've heard pretty convincing arguments that, like, you couldn't even consider, like, the country of France a nation until after World War One. I mean, there's very, it takes a long time to build a nation and is a relatively recent phenomenon, even in the West. So you have these countries in the Middle East that are just carved up through like imperial lines and arbitrary decisions made by just diplomats, you know, in Vienna or wherever. And so you just have situations where things don't fit together and lead to these various conflicts between groups of people, whether it's just because things are too hot or whether it's, you know, a long-standing ethnic conflict. So, and that's part of the issue here.
I mean, wouldn't it have been amazing though if we had invaded these countries like Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, and the most respected institution by the time we left was like the Minister of Power and Water or something like that, right? Like some really functional point. If that was the sort of the heroes that we had created, was a really smoothly functioning, efficient, non-corrupt, you know, deliverer of basic services that folks could look up to and see, that's what the purpose of a government is. That's what I want to support my government. I want to participate in elections, that it's not just about, you know, getting my guy into power because then he's going to give me these goodies or whatever. It's saying, look, if I support this, I'm going to get these services back. When I'm going to pay my taxes, or, you know, my country's oil revenues are going to go to fund this. Why wasn't that the emphasis? We haven't done anything in these countries. That's the most frustrating thing, beyond the fact that so many people died. The next most frustrating thing is always that we just didn't do anything in these countries. We went there, we broke it, we didn't fix anything. We didn't put anything back into place after that. But whatever was there, we destroyed it, and then we just left. We didn't put anything back into place. It's all just security, 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 and they don't even have anything working on that front either.
I completely agree. Again, we're spread too thin. We're not doing anything completely. We're not seeing a task from the beginning, information collection, to the end of leaving a, you know, a more secure nation for the citizens. So I agree completely. We need to do better.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line is Kelly. I want to talk now about the situation in Yemen. That's another one that we haven't necessarily been able to follow up on in a while, but I think it ties into a lot of what we've been talking about so far this hour, which is this idea of, you know, what's a nation state? How do you have an effective, stable government? What is the definition of an effective, stable government beyond security? And also this sort of reliance on unstrategic military superiority, just saying, because we have the capability of doing something, let's go ahead and do it. And that seems to be the approach taken in Yemen by Saudi Arabia, There's been definitely a lot of, again, I would say really credulous reporting going on there in the U.S. media, not really questioning things that are asserted by either U.S. officials or even worse by Saudi officials, both in terms of how the war is going, but also in terms of like why it's being fought in the first place. I mean, we've reached a point where Saudi Arabia is essentially trying to claim that they're saving Yemen for multi-party democracy, which is probably the most patently absurd claim that Saudi Arabia has made in the past 40 years. I mean, to suggest that Saudi Arabia is on a, for lack of a better word, crusade for democracy in Yemen. They're just not. That's not the case. Worse, it seems like they're, in fact, destroying Yemen completely. We talked about this when the war started and a little bit after this as well, but it seems like Saudi Arabia has definitely a pretty nefarious agenda going on here. Not only are they not there to pursue multi-party democracy, it's not even clear that they're there to, you know, fix Yemen or put it back together or create a stable situation. I mean, it's Yemen we're talking about here, so maybe all the king's horses and all the king's men aren't going to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But Saudi Arabia is definitely not seem to be doing that. They are arming and providing, you know, Humvees and things like that, light armored vehicles, to the group that has titled themselves literally Southern Resistance. That doesn't seem like an encouraging sign for a country that's only been unified for 25 years between its northern and southern halves. Saudi Arabia opposed Yemeni unification repeatedly. They were very, very opposed to that. The government that they had put into place after the Arab Spring was filled with Southerners. They've concentrated their military efforts on Southerners, but things have really escalated in the past couple weeks. Just in the first week of August, we've seen the Saudi Arabia and the United Emirates putting 3,000 ground troops into place in the city of Aden. So that's sort of the situation we've got going on there.
Just to build on that point, we're currently seeing a large number of pro-government troops being supplied through arms coming from Saudi Arabia. They just recently captured a provincial capital in southern Yemen. Zanjibar is the capital of the Abyan province. There's been some gains. However, there was also a friendly fire incident where the Saudi-led airstrike basically hit their own fighters, killing 20. So, you know, you are seeing some friendly fire and some sort of fog of war type incidents where it's already extremely difficult, I guess, to differentiate between various militia groups sometimes or pro or anti-government fighters. And we are seeing some friendly fire incidents.
I mean, that's I'd say, the most charitable way you could put it. Part of the big narrative here that we've seen in the past 4 months that is very inconvenient for the official narrative coming from Saudi Arabia has been just repeated disastrous airstrikes. I mean, you know, we talked earlier about the U.S. when they have good ground intelligence being very effective in terms of Syrian airstrikes. But when we're talking about the Saudis, they are not at the, they are not operating at the same level at all. They seem to think that they are, but they are bombing refugee camps that are nowhere near, you know, the rebel sites. They are bombing pipelines that deliver water. We've now got 20 million people in Yemen without enough water to drink or bathe in, okay? 20 million people. We've got hundreds of thousands of people starving to death right now. And this is because Yemen has been blockaded by the Saudi Navy, has been bombed from the air by the Saudi Air Force. They are being ground into the dirt here. There is not going to be anything left in Yemen pretty soon at the rate they've been going. And this has just been sustained for months now without almost any interruption. It's been daily airstrikes. There's only been a couple days here and there that haven't had airstrikes. Saudi Arabia is just pounding away at Yemen. Any infrastructure that there was in this very poor country is being demolished. People are going to die in very large numbers. The United Nations estimating that there's going to be a major public health crisis. There's not going to be enough, you know, food, water, or medicine to keep people from having major outbreaks, cholera, things like that. This is going to start becoming very rampant. And all the while, you've got Saudi Arabia hitting their own allied troops on the ground. You know, they're friendly troops. They're hitting residential buildings that are as many as 5 kilometers away from any active positions that they could be targeting. None of it has made any sense. They have killed hundreds of civilians at this point. In terms of casualties, you know, civilian or otherwise, from both sides of the war, 3,000 people have been killed since the Saudi campaign started at the end of March, on March 23rd. So this has been, or March 26th, I think. So this has been escalating and just getting so bad. And the question is is Saudi Arabia even trying to fix the situation, or are they coming to the conclusion that they should just partition this country and just tear it apart so that it can't be a threat? I think that seems to be their approach, rather than the U.S. trying to hold countries together at all costs, you know, like never wanting to partition Iraq. We've got a situation where Saudi Arabia thinks that divide and conquer is the best strategy.
I'm just reading from an article here in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which I guess is just an AP article, but talking about how Médecins Sans Frontières, or this the Doctors Without Borders, have treated more than 10,000 since March, and including 5,000 who have undergone surgery. They're frequently having to turn away wounded from their hospitals. They're completely overrun. Some of these hospitals are basically right on the front lines, so there's like shells going off nearby, and they have boarded up windows to prevent against stray bullets. So we're seeing a potential humanitarian crisis here. And there's another article talking about how there's an increased risk of dengue fever, according to Doctors Without Borders. So there's possibilities of like amputations and things like that, just because of the severe lack of medicine and just basic health care. Apparently, in June, there were 3,000 cases of dengue fever reported in Yemen, probably a lot more. And of course, just war wounds, things like that will probably just increase the infection rates and transmission.
This country is so poor compared to Saudi Arabia. I mean, it was before. It was not really a functioning state to begin with, but this is not helping the situation. They've got, it's hard to estimate accurately, but they've got about 27 million people in the population, maybe closer to 30, depending on, you know, who's counting and how. But that's roughly the same population as Saudi Arabia, but with 1/20th of the national, you know, wealth per capita or whatever, right? Or the national income per capita. Like everyone was making so little money, and there aren't that many oil reserves in Yemen. That wasn't necessarily being distributed very widely anyway. And it's sort of running out. But the thing that I really want to stress here is that not only is Saudi Arabia taking a bad situation and making it just dramatically worse, but they are doing it with our help. We're not necessarily in the air with them or anything, but when they run out of bombs, which they literally did run out of bombs supposedly in like the first month, they've asked us for more and we have supplied it. And we have justified this to ourselves by saying they are fighting against Iranian proxies, supposedly, you know, these Iranian allied Houthi rebels. That, you know, I want bringing it back around to that first point in the beginning of the show when we talked about the Khorasan group in Syria. That's another situation where the U.S. media basically just prints a press release and doesn't question it a lot of times. There has been a lot of questions raised by skeptics of saying, how closely related is this to Iran? Iran does not have a lot of money to go around right now because of all the sanctions. What little money they have has been going to, you know, Hezbollah and the effort in Syria, and they're even having to make budget cuts there. They don't seem to have very strong presence in Yemen the way they do in these other countries, right? Yemen has not been a big priority for them. Moreover, Yemen is this huge gun culture country. I mean, it's maybe even more than the United States. It's got the second highest per capita gun ownership in the world, but we're not even talking about just little teeny tiny guns, right? We're talking about like rocket launchers and bazookas and stuff like that are just widely available because there so many people have for decades now, maybe a half century, probably since the Nasser era, have been providing weapons to everyone there, right? You've got the various Arab League countries providing weapons, Saudi Arabia providing weapons. You got the Soviet Union used to provide weapons. The U.S. used to provide weapons. Everyone has given Yemen weapons, and there's just tons and tons of guns there, and they've been fighting a lot, right? Not constantly, not necessarily toward each other all the time the way they are right now, but there's been a lot of fighting there. The idea that Iran is somehow the engine behind all this turmoil is kind of absurd and insulting to the hardworking Yemeni rebels who have been helping to do this all on their own, right? They don't really need help from Iran, and that's what most of the Iranians have said. Even Hezbollah was ordered to send down advisors there, and they were just like, no, I think you guys are good, because you've been doing insurgency activities in Yemen since before Hezbollah existed in Lebanon, since 1982. So the situation here is actively being aided and abetted by the United States. And again, it seems like a situation where we haven't taken any strategic considerations into account here. We're not thinking about anything logically. We're just plunging in and doing whatever without thinking through consequences or ramifications or our part in it. Why are we helping Saudi Arabia to destroy and tear apart this country that has already launched, you know, major Al-Qaeda type plots against the United States, right? We're creating a just massive unfettered incubator for terrorism here, more than was already the case. And, you know, we just constantly are destroying Yemen, and this is now taking it to all new levels.
I just want to underscore, you know, the humanitarian side of this. As you've been mentioning, we can't continue to sort of get involved in these situations because the people on the ground there don't have the option to sort of get involved. They're in it, and we need to, you know, appreciate that and make some better decisions in the Middle East, or else this is going to go on for a very long time. And we're giving people there, you know, enough fire to continue their crusades against Americans and against what America stands for, because it's not totally clear what we stand for if you look at our Middle East policy.
Well put. Last segment, I'm Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line is Kelly. This is going to be a short one. Iran deal. What are we thinking on that right now at this point? And maybe we'll elaborate more on some future shows. But Nate, what's been your take so far on the Iran deal as it's been announced and sort of the U.S. political angle there?
This is something that has been needed for a long time, and it is upsetting to see certain members of, you know, the Democratic Party starting to turn against it. Obviously, Chuck Schumer has been a pretty vocal about it, and obviously he's a senior member in the Democratic Party. I just want to, if this deal somehow scuttled or, you know, prevented from being passed in Congress, it leaves you with a lot of just complete, I guess, despair about the future of U.S.-Iranian relations just going into the future. Because if we can't sort of work on a compromise like this, or we're going to try to reject it for whatever reason, you just don't have a great feeling that there's going to be another deal on the table like this anytime soon. You know, maybe in like another like 5-8 years, but the situation could have dramatically changed by then. I mean, we don't quite know how things are going to unfold in the future. And it seems very, very misguided to try to make some sort of stand right here about how it is, it's critical that we not let Iran develop this capability or whatever the arguments might be against it. And there's been a lot of different arguments. But yeah, I mean, we need to work on a compromise like this. I do not agree that it is in Iran's strategic interest to use nuclear weapons in any case. But even, you know, stepping aside from that, you know, it should be something that the U.S. tries to work with Iran diplomatically on. Otherwise, we're just going to further isolate Iran. They're probably going to develop functional nuclear weapons at some point. And then, okay, are we going to invade them? Or are we just going to let them stand off? It's going to be even worse of a decision and a debate. So this is, I think, the one step that we have to take now in order to ensure that there's not a literal flashpoint at some point in the future with Iran.
This seems to be the last sort of opportunity here, right?
Well, like, we don't necessarily know that, but at the same time, if you blow up this one in spectacular fashion, then when is the next one going to happen?
Right.
Is my question.
And the thing that I've been thinking about is, like, there's so much talk about how can we trust Iran. Okay, you could flip that around.
How can
around
Iran trust us is actually
exactly
a better question.
Right. So you can flip that question around and say, well, why should Iran trust the U.S.? And there's even longer stuff before the Iraq War, obviously. Various crises here. I think it's obviously a little bit disingenuous for Republicans to say, you know, how could we possibly do a deal with Iran like Ronald Reagan didn't? Like, come on. Ronald Reagan did deals with Iran. Like, Iran-Contra, it's literally in the name.
Bill, you know, it's important to be able to launder and funnel our money from, like, one place to the other. I mean, you got to sell weapons to the Nicaraguans, you know, the Contras, you know, funnel cocaine money somewhere. The CIA has got a lot of business to deal with, Bill. I mean, they just got accounts all over the place, so.
Right. But the other thing is, I'm thinking about all the countries that we have relationships with or don't have relationships with, all the different countries in the Middle East. They're all pursuing their own agendas. We've been talking about that for this whole entire hour at this point now. You know, the Saudis doing one thing, the Qataris doing another thing, the UAE doing this, Turkey doing that. All these countries have their own agendas. They don't necessarily do what the U.S. wants. They certainly don't do what Israel wants. Why is it that Iran is so, quote unquote, untrustworthy relative to all these other countries? How is it that we're able to deal with these other countries, but supposedly Iran is in this magical category that, you know, can't be compared to any of these other countries? That, to me, rings so hollow. We are constantly making deals with people we don't trust or whatever. And like, you hope that you've come up with a mechanism to enforce that, to inspect that. It seems like we have. You know, another thing that's a key feature of this deal is literally taking away Iran's uranium, right? We're taking, you know, people don't seem to understand. It takes X amount of uranium to make a functional nuclear warhead. If you take 90% away and that is less than X, you can't make a nuclear warhead. That seems to have been lost on some people. I think that they think that you can just make a really teeny tiny nuclear weapon at that point. It doesn't work like that, right? You have, in order to make a bomb, you have to have a certain amount of uranium, and they're having to give that up. That's a major concession. I don't know why we can't trust Iran, but we can trust so many other countries. Kelly, what were your thoughts, especially on the U.S. political angle here?
Yeah, from the political angle, I think that it is a transparent and disingenuous move for many of the politicians who are opposed to the bill, because, I mean, at the end of the day, Obama will probably be able to veto any opposition to the bill, even if it passes. It doesn't appear at this moment that there's the real threat of this not going through. However, you know, I feel like the eyes of the world are on us. We negotiated this for months. The world was pretty excited about what we had done and what we were able to work out with Iran. So to sort of grab the headlines for an evening to say you're opposed to it because, you know, you're tough on Iran, just like you've been, you know, tough on crime and tough on drugs and all that, you know, seems incredibly shallow to me. And I wish there was more integrity when it came to discussing this deal, the real options that we have, because we don't have unlimited options. And, you know, the fact that this, you know, just as Iran could violate the deal, at the end of the day, if we have to, we could also. So I think that it's a good first step, you know, trust but verify. And I think that it leaves us a lot of wiggle room. It leaves, you know, I think we got what we needed, maybe not what we wanted, but we needed out of the deal. And I wish, you know, politicians, you know, stop trying to get sound bites out of it.
Yeah, I think one other thing that maybe we need to touch on is just the domestic political debate surrounding this treaty and just certain accusations thrown out that if you question the motivations of opponents to this treaty, or you say that, you know, there are lobbying efforts by pro-Israel groups to defeat this treaty and whatnot, that somehow plays into like anti-Semitic tropes about Jews controlling, you know, media and government organizations and, you know, obviously money and finance and things like that. We've talked about this before on the show, but I think that is sort of an anti-democratic way to take to basically shut off debate rather than actually taking a, you know, sort of serious look at, okay, what does it mean to be in an alliance with another nation? What does it mean to support them, you know, unequivocally versus offering constructive advice and breaking with them when it is necessary, when it is, you know, not in anyone's interest for them to pursue a specific policy? Because you can argue that a lot of things that Israel has done in the long term probably don't serve its own interests and it doesn't really serve U.S. interests. But, you know, getting beyond that, I think there are people that will like stringently deny the existence of an Israel lobby. Of course, the Walton Mearsheimer paper, there was a lot of backlash against that. But at the end of the day, I mean, I've got relatives who have been to the AIPAC conference. It's a lobbying group for a close U.S.-Israel alliance. I mean, that's what it is. It's not to call it an Israel lobby is not to suggest like the protocols of the Elders of Zion are going to like descend upon the U.S. and they're about to start ruling the country. No, I mean, it is what it is. There are pro-Israel lobbying groups that are not as hard line. Okay, they're not promoting a lockstep alliance between the U.S. and Israel, but they're purported or they're looking for an alliance with the U.S. and Israel. We've established that the Israel lobby does exist. We've established that it's not uniform. This is so non-controversial that it should just be like so blasé to even talk about it. But apparently, like according to some people, that you start throwing up, you know, basically, you know, the bankers are going to like control the world or something. I mean, that's what some of these people will throw out there in an attempt to sort of stifle a bit of debate. And I think it's just, you should be able to talk about this. Okay, this is not saying that they're trying to hijack the U.S. democratic process and like have dual loyalties and like some sort of fifth column. But at the same time, when you're having a public debate about something like this, I don't think it's unreasonable to say, okay, there are groups lobbying for it, there are groups lobbying against it. Like, what is the impact of these lobbies and what are the political power they control? Because, I mean, the American Israel Political Action Committee is one of the most powerful, you know, lobbies in the U.S. And, I mean, there have been academic researches on, you know, quote-unquote foreign lobbies. They're not the only one that exists. I mean, there's a Turkey lobby that's pretty powerful. Like, there's even a lobby for the Armenians, you know, the Armenian genocide, get it recognized. Like, these are important things. And if you're a foreign country, you obviously lobby one of the most powerful nations in the world to do things that would benefit you. Just the question we have to ask ourselves as Americans is, would it actually be beneficial to not be in a state of, you know, on the precipice of war with the Iranians in perpetuity? I mean, when would this end if we don't come to some sort of deal? Right. So, I mean, that's the thing we need to be focusing on.
As you said, Nate, it's important to always reassess alliances and make sure that they are indeed mutually beneficial and that individual actions undertaken aren't going to, you know, drag everyone over a cliff. I think the phrase there is you don't want an alliance to be a suicide pact.
Yeah, right? And you can have an alliance without, you know, working, you know, in exactly the same fashion, exactly the same way. You can have like constructive disagreements. And I think that's something that gets lost, you know, sometimes when we're talking about Israel.
We are at the end of our time. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Nate, thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.